the city offering a solution. But this contract ended up being a disaster. Not only did it not meet their promises, the automated meters didn't work really at all. Many people stopped getting bills. Those who got bills received ones that were far too high and did not pay them. And so it created massive deficits and ultimately led to a lawsuit that was filed by the city. And ultimately, they agreed to a settlement. Siemens agreed to a settlement. But in the interim, there was essentially a lost decade where the system deteriorated further and there were really no substantial investments made. And that's part of the reason why we see what's going on today, which is a boil water order, undrinkable water, and probably more trouble in the months and years ahead.
And talk about the role of U.S. Consolidated, a company owned by former Mississippi state politician and lobbyist Tom Wallace.
Well, that part of the issue with this contract was that Siemens had agreed to get a fairly high percentage, I believe it was 58% of minority-owned businesses. But instead of finding qualified subcontractors to do this, the city alleged that it essentially partnered with shell companies who did no work, including this very highly connected former legislator who owns U.S. Consolidated, essentially would just act as a pass-through. They would buy the meters from one company, sell them to the city for a markup. Another company would install them. So essentially this one company, U.S. Consolidated, was paid $20 million for, according to the city's lawsuit, essentially doing no work at all.
What happened to the $90 million from the settlement? Why is Jackson's water system still such a disaster?
Well, a third of it went to the lawyers that filed the suit. And as I mentioned, there were large deficits that were created because of the inability to collect fees while these meters were in place. So some of it had to go to fulfill those deficits. And then, although the cost of the contract was $90 million, Jackson obviously didn't have $90 million sitting around. They issued bonds. The total cost of those bonds were $200 million. And the issuance of those bonds requires them to maintain a reserve fund. So between the lawyers, the deficit were created, and the reserve fund, there was very little left, less than $10 million from this $90 million settlement that Jackson had to reinvest in the water
and
system.
Siemens saying, Judd, that they went above and beyond their contractual obligations?
Well, that's what they're saying. Obviously, they agreed to pay $90 million, the full amount of the contract. So they must have they acknowledged at least implicitly there that this didn't go well. When I contacted Siemens looking for comments on what's going on now, they said due to the nature of the settlement, they couldn't discuss it any further.
What's next and what has most shocked you in your research? We have 30 seconds.
Well, next they're going to try to find the money to pay for this. So far, the state has been very reticent to do so. There is federal money coming in through the infrastructure bill last year through the American Recovery Act. And it's a matter of convincing the state to allow those funds to flow to Jackson. That would at least be a start in doing what's now seen as up to $2 billion in improvements necessary to get clean water to the people of Jackson.
And Governor Reeves saying privatization's the answer?
Governor Reeves is now looking at privatization. And so, you know, we may see history repeating itself. We'll have to see.
Judd Legum, founder of Popular Information. We will link to his new piece. This multi-billion-dollar corporation exacerbated the water crisis in Jackson, Mississippi. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
Take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Marjorie Cohn continues to keep us informed about the ongoing investigation of classified records taken from Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago compound.
Donald Trump is trying to get a special master appointed to delay the investigation.
We'll also be joined by Thomas Hanna, who will speak with us about nationalizing the fossil fuel industry.
He will tell us how to shift from capitalist ownership of the companies to public ownership. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
On August 8th, FBI agents seized 33 boxes, containers, or items of evidence with more than 100 classified records from Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago compound. They included information classified at the highest levels. The Department of Justice had applied for the search warrant after Trump stonewalled them for 7 months. A federal judge found probable cause to believe that agents would find evidence of 3 federal crimes at Mar-a-Lago. They include a violation of the Espionage Act, which has recently been used to prosecute whistleblowers, publishers, and journalists who publicize evidence of government wrongdoing. Trump claims that the documents are his, but in fact, they belong to the National Archives. He is seeking the appointment of a special master to review the documents for possibly privileged material. Attorney General Merrick Garland will use the seized documents to inform his decision about whether to indict Trump and/or his associates. Here to help us navigate this rapidly developing story is Law and Disorder co-host Marjorie Cohn, a former criminal defense attorney and professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Marjorie does frequent written and broadcast commentary about these and other legal and political issues. Marjorie, welcome to the guest chair on Law and Disorder.
I'm so happy to be here, Heidi.
Marjorie, the Department of Justice is investigating the improper removal and storage of classified documents in unauthorized places and the unlawful concealing or removal of government records. Why did the Department of Justice seek a warrant to search Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago compound?
Well, from May of 2021 until December of 2021, the U.S. National Archives and Records Administration, also known as NARA, repeatedly asked Trump for documents that were stored at Mar-a-Lago. Trump stonewalled for 7 months. He insisted they're mine when he was urged to return the boxes of information. Well, in January of 2022, NARA received 15 boxes of records from Trump, and they said that of most significant concern was that highly classified records were unfoldered, intermixed with other records, and otherwise improperly identified. Now, Trump claimed he was fully cooperative with government personnel who came to Mar-a-Lago on June 3rd, pursuant to a grand jury subpoena. But on June 3rd, Trump's lawyer explicitly prohibited the FBI from opening or looking inside any of the boxes that remained in the storage room.
What did 14 of the 15 boxes contain?
They had classification markings. 67 were marked confidential, 92 were marked secret, and 25 were marked top secret. And each of these markings respectively indicates an increased threat of harm to national security if the information is disclosed without authorization. Several documents contained what appeared to be Trump's handwritten notes. And the FBI agents also noticed markings that said HCS, FISA, ORCON, NOFORN, and SI.
Marjorie, what did those classification codes mean?
Well, HCS means intelligence information from human intelligence or clandestine human sources. FISA stands for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which protects intelligence information from sources that are authorized by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. ORCON means originator controlled. That is, dissemination beyond pre-approved entities requires the approval of the originator. NOFORN means not releasable to foreign nationals, governments, U.S. citizens without permission of the originator. And SI means special intelligence, which is designed to protect technical and intelligence information gleaned from the monitoring of foreign communication signals by other than the intended recipients. So basically, NARA found more than 100 documents with classification markings comprising more than 700 pages.
Judge Bruce Reinhardt found probable cause to believe that documents from Mar-a-Lago constitute evidence of three federal crimes. What are those crimes?
Well, Section 793E of the Espionage Act prohibits the unauthorized possession, access, control of any document relating to national defense and also forbids the willful retention of national defense information and failure to deliver it to the U.S., to a U.S. officer or employee who's entitled to receive it. Secondly, Section 1519 of 18 U.S.C., which is the U.S. Code section, prohibits obstruction. Anyone who knowingly alters, destroys, mutilates, conceals, covers up, falsifies, or makes a false entry in a record or document with the intent to obstruct the investigation. And Section 2017 prohibits concealment or removal of government materials. Anyone who willfully and unlawfully conceals, removes, mutilates, obliterates, or destroys, or attempts to do so with the intent to do so and takes it and carries it away.
And what penalties do those crimes carry?
The Espionage Act provision carries 10 years in prison, the obstruction provision 20 years in prison, and the concealment or removal provision 3 years in prison.
Now, the Department of Justice filed an affidavit which Judge Reinhardt used to make the probable cause determination. That affidavit was unsealed. What do affidavits contain? Is it normal for a judge to make a search warrant public? And why did the judge resist unsealing it?
Well, affidavits typically include critical information about an investigation, including facts about why the government wants to search a certain location and what evidence of a crime they expect to find there. They contain statements from informants. They indicate avenues that will be pursued during the investigation. And the Department of Justice in this case is investigating the improper removal and storage of classified documents in unauthorized places and the unlawful concealing or removal of government records. The FBI's interviewed a significant number of civilian witnesses, but the affidavit says the FBI had not yet identified all potential criminal confederates, nor located all evidence related to its investigation. It's highly unusual to unseal a search warrant affidavit before criminal charges are filed. In fact, affidavits generally are unsealed only after the defendant makes a motion to suppress evidence that was seized in the search. In other words, to exclude the evidence from his or her trial because the search violated their Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure. No charges have yet been filed in this case, but because of strong public interest in the search of Trump's home and the seizure of hundreds of classified documents, the judge unsealed the affidavit, albeit with extensive redactions. That means blacking out things that would identify informants or avenues of investigation. And the judge, Reinhart, who issued the search warrant, wrote in his order unsealing the affidavit that the government had shown a compelling reason, good cause, to seal portions of the affidavit because disclosure would reveal the identities of witnesses, law enforcement agents, and uncharged parties, as well as the investigation strategy, direction, scope, sources, and methods, and grand jury information that is protected by the federal rules of criminal procedure. But once the Department of Justice came forward with extensive redactions, the judge agreed to unseal that redacted affidavit.
What did the search warrant authorize the agents to seize?
Well, Judge Reinhart issued a search warrant that authorized the search of Mar-a-Lago and the seizure of physical documents and records constituting evidence, contraband, fruits of crime, or other items illegally possessed that violate those three federal code sections that I described. The warrant also authorized the seizure of any evidence regarding storage or transmission of national defense information and evidence of knowing alteration, destruction or concealment of any government and or presidential records or documents with classification markings.
And what did the agents seize during their search on August 8th?
Well, they seized 11 sets of classified documents, including several secret, top secret, and confidential documents, and they seized documents marked SCI, which means sensitive compartmented information or highly classified information. And the Department of Justice wrote in its recent pleading that the FBI, in a matter of hours, recovered twice as many documents with classification markings as the, quote, diligent search, unquote, that the former president's counsel and other representatives had weeks to perform, calls into serious question the representations made in the June 3rd certification and casts doubt on the extent of cooperation in this matter.
Trump claims that he declassified all the documents at Mar-a-Lago. Is this a valid claim, and what are the legal ramifications if it is valid?
Well, Trump claimed that he really didn't have classified documents because he had issued a blanket declassification of all documents. And he claimed that the president has absolute authority to declassify documents. Now, that is a matter of legal dispute, whether a president can issue blanket declassification orders. I don't think any has ever happened. But none of the 18 former White House aides and advisors that CNN interviewed had ever heard that Trump issued a blanket declassification order, and they said they believed that claim was patently false. But setting aside the question of whether a president has the authority to declassify documents en masse, none of the three federal code sections that I mentioned that the judge found probable cause to believe would be supported by evidence found at Mar-a-Lago, none of those three federal code sections require that the offending documents be classified. So it's really a red herring that Trump has raised
Donald Trump claims that the seized documents are protected by the attorney-client privilege or executive privilege. He's filed a motion for the appointment of a special master to review the seized documents. What is his strategy? And also, Marjorie, a Trump-appointed judge held a hearing on September 1st. What's likely to happen with that?
Well, on August the 22nd, Trump filed a motion in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida requesting the appointment of a special master to review the documents seized at Mar-a-Lago. And a special master is generally a retired judge, a third party. Trump wants this special master to inspect these documents to see if they're privileged or potentially privileged, if they contain privileged or potentially privileged information. But the Department of Justice's filter team had already segregated documents that might be protected by the attorney-client privilege or executive privilege. Trump waited 2 weeks after the search to file this motion, and the Department of Justice's team had already gone through them. Trump's motion to appoint this special master is pending before Judge Eileen Cannon, who happens to be a Trump appointee. And Cannon indicated that she's inclined to agree with Trump and appoint a special master. She held an almost two-hour hearing on September 1st, but hasn't issued a ruling. She's apparently going to issue a written ruling. The appointment of a special master could substantially delay the Department of Justice's criminal investigation of Trump and his associates. And the DOJ says that appointing a special master is unnecessary because their filter team has already segregated potentially privileged documents. And the DOJ says that appointing a special master would impede the government's ongoing criminal investigation and the intelligence community from conducting its ongoing review of the national security risk that improper storage of these highly sensitive materials may have caused and identifying measures to rectify or mitigate damage. The DOJ, Department of Justice, also argues that Trump lacks standing. In other words, he does not have the legal right to come in and ask for a special master or the return of the documents since he doesn't own them. The Presidential Records Act says presidential records are the property of the government. Now, on September 2nd, the day after the hearing on the special master request, Judge Cannon unsealed a fuller list of what had been seized on August the 8th. It included multiple empty folders with classification markings, leaving the implication that someone had removed the classified documents in those folders.
One of the crimes Judge Reinhart listed is a violation of a section of the Espionage Act. It was originally enacted to punish spying, but has recently been used to prosecute whistleblowers, publishers, and journalists for revealing evidence of government wrongdoing. Is this a proper use of the Espionage Act? And in your opinion, should it be used to prosecute Trump and/or his associates?
Well, as you said, it has been used to prosecute whistleblowers and publishers and journalists. In the 70s, the government used the Espionage Act to prosecute Daniel Ellsberg for leaking the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. And then it really wasn't used until Obama came into office, and he prosecuted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all prior presidents combined. And some of the people who have been prosecuted under the Espionage Act more recently, whistleblowers, include Edward Snowden, Thomas Drake, William Binney. They disclosed evidence about the NSA, National Security Agency's Mass Domestic Surveillance Program. It also includes John Kiriakou, who revealed the CIA's torture program, and Daniel Hale, who revealed information about the illegal drone assassination program. And of course, Julian Assange, who is a publisher and journalist facing 170 years under the Espionage Act for revealing evidence of U.S. war crimes. There are problems with the Espionage Act because it does not distinguish between government insiders like Donald Trump, who could share national security information with foreign powers to harm the United States, from those who share information with the media to publicize to the American public government misconduct and criminal behavior. And there are really compelling reasons that Congress should amend the Espionage Act. But the fact that the law is being used against Trump is not one of those reasons. Now, Trump could be charged under the other two felonies I mentioned, and one of those felonies carries 20 years in prison, whereas the Espionage Act violation carries 10 years in prison. But another problem with the Espionage Act is that the intent of the defendant is irrelevant. So it doesn't matter whether someone discloses information, say classified information, to a hostile foreign power for profit or leaks it to the media because they think the public has a right to know about government wrongdoing. Also, there's no public interest defense. They can't assert, people charged under the Espionage Act can't assert that they revealed the information in the interest of the public. So, long story short, yes, there are lots of problems with the Espionage Act. It was not designed to, nor should it be used to, prosecute whistleblowers, publishers, and journalists. But prosecuting Trump under the Espionage Act is not such a far-fetched notion, although he could be prosecuted ultimately under those other two felonies, depending upon what Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, decides to do.
Marjorie, do you think Attorney General Merrick Garland will indict Trump for federal offenses for unauthorized possession, retention and concealment, and obstruction of government documents?
Well, he's not going to indict anyone before the midterm elections, but the investigation is ongoing, and the bottom line is that this should be a legal, not a political determination.
And what are the likely ramifications if Garland does or does not indict Trump?
If he does indict Trump, there have been threats of violence in the streets from the radical right wing, the MAGA people. If he doesn't indict Trump, it means that Donald Trump is above the law, in effect.
If Trump is indicted and convicted, would he legally be disqualified from being president again?
Well, Section 2017, which carries up to 3 years in prison, that's the unlawful concealment or removal of documents, says that someone convicted under that section shall be disqualified from holding any federal office. The problem is, how would that be enforced? Congress would likely say Article 2 of the Constitution only provides three different qualifications for a president. President has to be a natural-born citizen, at least 35 years of age, and a resident of the United States for at least 14 years. Now, the Supreme Court has never ruled on whether a presidential candidate whose eligibility was challenged because he was convicted under this law that provides for disqualification can actually be disqualified. So the bottom line is, we don't know.
Marjorie, we look forward to continuing this discussion as the case unfolds with you. In the meantime, how can our listeners follow your work?
In addition to the interviews that you and I do on Law and Disorder Radio, I write a weekly column for truthout.org. My column is called Human Rights and Global Wrongs, and my work is collected on my website at marjoriecohn.com.
Marjorie Cohn, thank you so much for your work on this.
Thank you, Heidi. Thanks for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Diana has been the research director for the Democracy Collaborative since 2015, after working for 5 years as a research assistant to Gar Alperovitz, a co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative and well-known historian and political economist. The Democracy Collaborative was founded in 2000 as a research center at the University of Maryland to develop a theoretical and historical framework for building a truly democratic society based on the principles of democratic economy, community wealth building, and the democratization of ownership. Hannah's areas of expertise include public ownership, privatization, local government, democratic ownership, and banking. He is the author and editor of a number of books, articles, and reports, including Our Commonwealth, The Return of Public Ownership in the United States, which was published by Manchester University Press in 2018. Hannah's recent article, The Supreme Court is Gutting the Regulatory State, Let's Look at Our Other Options, published in These Times in July of this year, provides a fascinating analysis of the historical evolution of the regulatory system in the United States. Since the New Deal and the end of World War II, the use of regulatory legislation has been used to protect capitalism based on the notion that, and I quote, the excesses and injustices of capitalism can be ameliorated primarily through state regulation of private enterprise rather than large order shifts in the ownerships of these enterprises, end quote. In his article, Hannah articulately explains how these historical attempts to regulate capitalist power within the context of capitalism is destined to fail because of its own structural limitations. In the wake of the existential threat of catastrophic climate change and rising tide of right-wing extremism, we are seeing, predictably, the explicit dismantling of that regulatory system. Hannah explores the recent rulings from the new right-wing majority of the U.S. Supreme Court, particularly the case of West Virginia versus EPA, in which the court literally kneecapped the agency's ability to reduce the devastating effects of corporate pollution in order to protect private profit and quote-unquote free enterprise. Hannah explores an alternative vision of creating a system of economic and political democracy based on public and collective ownership of important assets, enterprises, and services, including the fossil fuel industry, as an alternative to regulation. Thomas, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
We are thrilled to have a chance to talk with you today about your article, what has led you here, and most of all, how you see us getting from here to there. In your article, you give a very interesting and well-stated historical overview of the development of regulatory capitalism, going back to the New Deal. Can you help our listeners understand this history?
Yeah. So, you know, governments have been regulating private enterprise for thousands and thousands of years. But I think what we're talking about here really has its roots in the laissez-faire ideology that developed in some capitalist countries during the Industrial Revolution. And laissez-faire is basically this idea that government should not try and limit the activities of private companies and private individuals. And this really led to all sorts of abuses and problems, as you can imagine. You know, labor abuses. You see the pictures of children in the mines and so on and so forth, environmental damage, really poor food quality, and so on and so forth. So in the early 20th century, you really started to see some pushback against this ideology with things like food and drug regulation, the trust-busting breakups of like Standard Oil and some of the other large corporations, and some pretty large-scale interventions into the economy during World War I. But the real death blow, I think, to this laissez-faire ideology was the financial crisis of 1929 and the Great Depression. And the Depression really convinced a lot of people that more active government involvement in regulating the economy was necessary. And the resulting New Deal and World War II mobilization really kind of ushered in a golden era of regulated capitalism, marked by strong oversight of private business, pretty relatively empowered trade unions, at least comparatively to both you know, previous to that and to the future, and also pretty significant improvements in health, prosperity, reducing poverty and economic development. And this model really kind of held until the 1970s, but was ultimately eclipsed by a new model, a model that we call neoliberalism, which really focused in on deregulation, privatization, you know, marketization, globalization, and so on and so forth. And that's the model that we've been living with from basically the 1970s on until today.
What is the difference between social democracy and democratic socialism?
Yeah, originally social democracy was often simply just another word for socialism, but pretty early on in the late 19th century, it came to refer to this idea that society could transition from capitalism to socialism peacefully via democratic political institutions. So at that time, it was really kind of opposed to or the opposite of revolutionary socialism, which was this idea that the transition to socialism would need to be violent and ruptural. However, as the 20th century progressed, social democracy has really evolved, and in its modern form, it most often refers to a political and economic system that's based on regulating private business rather than directly owning the means of production, and then combining this with a pretty strong social safety net, and as well as expanding rights for individuals and groups in society. So, in other words, social democracy as currently practiced is mostly about mitigating some of the worst excesses of capitalism rather than transitioning to socialism in any meaningful way. And in terms of democratic socialism, I think you'll probably find there are many different interpretations of that. But for me, democratic socialism is really about collective control of the means of production combined with some form of democratic politics. So for me, in many ways, democratic socialism really resembles the original idea of social democracy, while at the same time, social democracy itself has kind of shifted significantly to the right.
Very interesting and very well explained. What is it, Thomas, about our system of capitalism that creates or contributes to the structural limitations you refer to in your article and that you just sort of explained in your answer? You wrote that the contemporary model of regulating private enterprise and blunting the worst excesses of capitalism is failing.
Yeah, I mean, at its core, capitalism is all about private profit. And if there's anything that really gets in the way of making or maintaining or maximizing private profit in either the short or the long term, it really must be overcome. And this is simply how capitalism works. It's how it's always worked, and it's how it always will work. That's the structure of capitalism. So things like environmental regulations, labor laws, antitrust strategies, or anything else that's designed to potentially check or limit the profit-making activities of a private company or a private individual is ultimately a threat that these people or these institutions need to overcome. And I know that's a really, really simplistic explanation, but we've actually seen it play out throughout U.S. history, especially over the past 50 years. Corporations and the wealthy elite in this country have been extremely active and extremely successful in undermining economic regulation and laws that they don't like. And has had really predictable consequences and outcomes. You know, we have seen rising inequality, persistent poverty, you know, declining union power, and quite profound environmental destruction over these decades. And at the same time, we've seen the wealth of the top 1% and the top, you know, 10, 5% increasing significantly, their share of income going up, you know, exponentially, while the rest of people in the bottom 20 or 40% or 50% or even 80% have seen their wages stagnating. So they've been very successful in what they have tried since the 1970s to sort of undermine the regulatory state that had developed. And ultimately, it's all about wealth and power. So what I mean when I say that the social democratic model of regulating private enterprises is structurally limited is that if you leave large corporations and concentrate of capital in private hands, there's really a limit to what you can achieve. The second that you really start to challenge or actually challenge their wealth and power, they're just going to use that wealth and power to unravel those attempts to control them or to rein them in. And because of this reality, this social democratic model is really in retreat around the world, not only in the United States, but even in its European heartlands. I mean, if you think about, you know, social democracy, you often get a picture of, you know, Sweden or Finland or Germany or even France. But in all of these areas, as I discussed in the article, you see social democratic policies under attack. You see inequality rising. You see the power of the elites and corporations sort of increasing in those countries. So what they were able to do there and here was, for a very short period of time after World War II, really put in place this model, but it was quickly eroded and undermined over the decades.
Thomas, you explain the current wave of politically and ideologically motivated decisions of the Supreme Court, in particular, one case, West Virginia versus EPA. In that case, the regulatory power of the EPA was literally eviscerated in one fell swoop. Can you explain the ruling in that case, please?
Sure. The West Virginia versus EPA case was pretty unique for several reasons, and I think it really demonstrates the commitment of this court's conservative judges, the six conservative judges, to really dismantle as much as they can of what's left of the country's regulatory apparatus. And basically, the court ruled that the EPA had overstepped its authority by propagating the Clean Power Plan rule during the Obama era. And this was a rule that was designed to require utility companies to make certain changes to their energy generation and efficiency programs. And the rule itself was actually scrapped by the Trump administration and never enacted, which kind of makes it highly unusual that the court actually took up the ruling and ruled on the case. But most importantly, for the first time, the court really explicitly deployed what's called the major questions doctrine, which, as I wrote in the article, is a new and really controversial judicially created concept. And the doctrine holds that the Supreme Court can intervene and strike down a regulatory agency's action if it, quote-unquote, concerns an issue of vast economic and political significance. So basically, this very conservative Supreme Court that we have just up and gave itself the power to strike down regulations based on a very ambiguous and subjective standard.
Shifting over to the substance of that opinion and the attempts by the EPA to regulate the fossil fuel industry. What is the significance of this opinion as it pertains to your analysis of the fossil fuel industry and the existential threat to our climate that we are now experiencing?
Yeah, well, even prior to this recent ruling against the EPA, efforts to use regulations and legislation to get private companies, you know, especially these big fossil fuel companies, but to get private companies to shift their climate-destroying practices, it's really been a dismal failure. You know, we've literally known about the dangers of climate change since the 1970s. Our government knew, even Exxon scientists knew, but we've been really totally unable to do anything about it because of the political and economic power of these very large companies who have, you know, they've financed climate denialism. They've blocked new legislation, and they've really systemically undermined the existing regulations. And these are some of the biggest, most powerful, and wealthiest companies in human history, and they would really rather see the world burn than their profits eroded. I mean, just in the past 6 months, we've seen rivers drying up across Europe and China, months of record heat in India, you know, recent catastrophic flooding in Pakistan, and now there's a massive heat wave, you know, it's about to hit the already drought-stricken U.S. West. And at the same time, these fossil fuel companies have just raked in record profits due to the energy spikes related to the war in Ukraine and other factors. So, you know, we're faced with this reality, and there's only one remaining option given the really rapidly shrinking timeframes that we have to deal with climate change. We just simply must take these companies over and dismantle or repurpose them in an orderly fashion.
Thomas, you talk about transformation of ownership. Can you explain what that means, please?
Yeah, ownership can convey a number of different rights and benefits, but in this case, I think what is most important is really control and purpose. So in private hands, you know, in the type of capitalist system that we have, the public really has very limited ability to control what these companies do or do not do. That's what we've been talking about with regards to the limits of regulation. And so as we've discussed, it's really about mostly turning a profit no matter the consequence. That's the goal and the purpose of these corporations. But by shifting ownership to the public, you know, either directly or through some sort of representative government at various scales, it really opens up a range of other options beyond profit. Private ownership is really constrained in what its objectives can be, whereas public ownership is really an inherently flexible ownership form. So public ownership would remove the power of these fossil fuel interests from our political system and essentially give us the control necessary to make the large order shifts that we need to address the climate crisis. And also, I think really critically, it allows us to do it in a planned and orderly way that doesn't lead to widespread shortages and suffering as we do this critical transition strategy.
Well, as you point out in your article, Thomas, nationalized businesses in this country is not a new phenomenon. We have experienced it in the past. Can you explain to our listeners both this history and what you are proposing now that is different from that?
Yeah, I once wrote an article that was titled Nationalization is as American as Apple Pie, and that was based on a report that I did. That was a sort of an investigation into this long history of nationalization going back all the way to World War I. And the U.S. government has just literally nationalized hundreds of companies over the years, often during times of economic or social crisis. And my favorite one is that in World War II, we nationalized the Montgomery Ward department store chain because its chairman, its CEO, was a free marketeer. He was not abiding by contracts with labor unions and FDR, and the government told him he needed to abide by these contracts, and he refused. And the U.S. Army actually dragged him out of his office in his chair and nationalized the company. So it's an incredible story. You know, in the 1970s, we nationalized passenger and freight railroads after really terrible mismanagement by the private railway companies. And again, you know, a little more than 10 years ago, we nationalized banks, insurance companies, and car manufacturers during the financial crisis during the late 2000s. But beyond this, you know, beyond the big nationalizations at the sort of federal level, public ownership itself remains pretty common in the United States, especially at the local and state level, and that's partly due to the way that our political system is more decentralized. So we have everything from publicly owned water utilities to banks to electric companies to broadband internet to land to transportation and so on and so forth. There's literally hundreds of thousands of publicly owned enterprises at the state and local level in the United States that have just been there in many cases for decades, just doing their thing, very efficient, very effective, very controversial. So none of this is uncommon in the U.S. experience. I guess what is perhaps a little unique is this idea of nationalizing an industry to decommission it or to convert it rather than simply nationalizing it temporarily until a crisis is over. But even here, I think there are precedents. So I mentioned passenger rail before, but we had Amtrak. And Amtrak, for instance, was created through the nationalization, reorganization, and really rationalization of several failing railroads and has been successfully in public hands for decades now and is even increasing, especially along the East Coast corridor where I live.
We're speaking today with Thomas Hanna, Research Director for the Democracy Collaborative, about public ownership of the fossil fuel industry. Thomas, in terms of confronting climate change with a shift to public ownership, can you please explain to our listeners how that would work?
Yeah, so I think in some regards we're a little bit behind the eight ball here. You know, some of the effects of climate change are already pretty baked in. You know, there was recently a report, I think the other day or a couple of days ago, about Greenland's collapsing glaciers. And basically, even the amount of carbon dioxide that we've pumped into the atmosphere already is basically guaranteed that these glaciers will collapse and we'll get up to a foot of sea rise. But climate change really isn't just an on-off switch, right? It's not just climate change or no climate change. There's really a continuum in how bad climate change is going to be. And at the edge of that continuum, it's the path that we're currently taking. We are literally on the path to some of the worst effects of climate change, effects that are going to be really catastrophic for many communities around the world. So we simply have to get off that path and onto a path that's more sustainable, and we really have to do it soon. You know, and that, I think, is one of the real benefits of nationalization versus regulation. And, you know, regulating and incentivizing private business to act, even if it works, is a really slow and fraught process, as we've seen over the past several decades. And as I said, there are no guarantees that the sort of regulating private industry or incentivizing it to do better is going to work. But by contrast, nationalization can be a really quick and effective tool. And that's why you often see nationalization being deployed in times of war or extreme crisis. It's a tool that the government can take now to do something very quickly to really effectuate a large order economic shift in a short period of time.
Thank you, Thomas. Within that context, what do you think about Joe Biden's newly enacted Inflation Reduction Act? Isn't that just another form of regulation, which in the face of what you've already pointed out, a crisis that we've known about for decades now, just another form of regulation that's too little, too late?
Well, I think that's definitely an apt analogy or analysis of the act. I think the IRA is definitely historic. I mean, for the first time in decades, the federal government is actually doing something to address climate change. But if you look at it closely, there's a lot of uncertainty about whether or not the stated reduction, I think it's 40% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030, will actually happen. Moreover, the act is full of these poison pill provisions, like it ties renewable energy development to more oil and gas extraction. So, you know, that doesn't seem to be the best strategy, in my opinion. And that's nothing to say nothing really about how this legislation will fare once the industry lobbyists start to sink their fangs into it. And I personally remember very clearly the Dodd-Frank law that was passed after the financial crisis, which was an attempt to sort of re-regulate the banking industry after the terrible financial crisis of the late 2000s. And it was a pretty insufficient piece of legislation to begin with, but then it was systematically undermined and weakened further by the industry lobbyists over the subsequent years. So as much as I think the IRA is important, I'm wary and dubious to see whether or not it's really going to be able to effectuate the change that it says. And also, I think it's insufficient anyway.
Interesting. You discuss the idea of collective decision making, and you write that society should decide how our resources are deployed. Who do you see as part of that collective decision making body?
Yeah, that's a good question. I personally see everybody in society as part of that collective decision-making body. I think we really need to move towards more genuine and direct forms of democracy. You know, our democratic system, it's very weak. It's a veneer of democracy in many ways, but there's lots of other ways in which we can practice democracy, ways in which we can have much more participatory and deliberative democratic practices. So I believe that there's a lot of evidence from political theory and other places of things like citizens' assemblies and different ways in which you can structure a democratic process in which everyone can sort of be a part of it, can weigh in, and can lead to much better outcomes.
What we're witnessing with the rapid and large-scale growth of an extremist white supremacist fascist movement in the United States, is our collective consciousness in this country capable of making such monumental decisions?
Well, I personally believe that a lot of what we're seeing in our society and politics actually reflects this profound lack of genuine democracy. We've really seen a concerted effort over the past several decades to undermine collective and community institutions and to really push this narrative of hyper-individualism and commercialism. And as I said, even before this, our version of democracy was pretty shallow and kind of narrowly constrained to this political theater of voting every couple of years. So for me, the answer to this growing extremism isn't to start retreating away from democracy, but really to actually double down on democracy and to make it much more robust, much more participatory, much more deliberative. And as I mentioned before, you know, I think there's considerable evidence out there from things like citizens' assemblies and these other deliberative mini-publics that when people actually are brought together in a meaningful way to discuss issues and when their conclusions actually have like real weight and power, people are able to come up with pretty good and actually usually pretty progressive solutions. So I'd say, yeah, I think we're definitely capable of collectively making these big, tough decisions about the future. And I think actually, if we're given the opportunity to do so, then it might start to correct some of these social fissures and divisions that are only getting worse and worse in this country.
Well, that is really an optimistic view, which I hope you're right. You talk about a two-pronged strategy for achieving this laudable goal of an equitable, democratic, and ecologically sustainable political economic system. What, if any, role do grassroots organizing efforts and our legal system play toward that goal?
I think sometimes people get caught up in one theory of change or another. You know, I think sometimes people think either everything has to be done from the ground up, you know, everything needs to be horizontal or from the community level, or that everything needs to happen top down, you know, through the political system, you know, state action, and that's the most quickest and most effective way to make change. But for me, it's really, we really need to have a combination of both of these strategies. So on the one hand, I fundamentally believe that we must build and expand cooperative and community ownership of enterprises, services, assets, and so on from the ground up. And there's really a lot of great work happening across the country around this goal, especially around things like the solidarity economy and so on and so forth. But we really have to connect this work that's happening on the ground with a more top-down intervention at larger scales. In order to get to the scale that we need in the time frames that are necessary, we simply have to work at larger scales in some places, especially in sectors that we've been talking about that have a really big impact on climate change or the environment. So I think what we really need to be doing is confronting and weakening corporate power, from the top down, while also building new institutions and building new approaches from the bottom up. And I think in terms of what organizers and our legal system can do to support these efforts, there's a lot of different roles to play. We're already seeing a lot of great organizing work on the ground in local communities around, for instance, taking over for-profit electric utilities, this remunicipalization efforts. And these campaigns need a lot of support, a lot of organizing support, but a lot of legal support as well. Going further than that, it's virtually guaranteed that any effort to nationalize large fossil fuel companies or to seize their assets at the state and local level, these efforts are going to end up in the courts at some point. Also, there's probably pretty likely to be international trade or agreement implications with some of these strategies as well. So I think having lawyers on board with these ideas and these strategies who are really experts in things like mergers and acquisitions or eminent domain and just compensation or international trade law, I think having these people involved is going to be absolutely critical to the success of any of these efforts.
Thomas, thank you so much for this important interview. And before we go, can our listeners follow your work?
Yeah, thank you all so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure. Our website is democracycollaborative.org, and you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Thomas M. Hanna.
Thank you so much for being with us. You've given our listeners lots of food for thought and some hopefulness as well in these difficult times.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
And you might say that the history of the American government since the end of the Vietnam War has been an attempt to destroy that spirit of rebellion that arose in the 1960s to control people more. Everything the government has been doing, the way it has waged wars, the way it has established control, the way it has made liaisons with the major media, right up to the Homeland Security Act, I think all of that. But it's important to take note of that. They don't want an excess of democracy. Our job is to have an excess of democracy.
That's Howard Zinn, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Howard Zinn, Questions and Answers in Albuquerque, a special program celebrating the Zinn centenary. There are piles and piles of tapes in Alternative Radio's 400-square-foot office. And under one pile, I uncovered this recording of the legendary historian Howard Zinn in conversation with students and faculty at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. I recorded the event in a jam-packed classroom on a warm afternoon in September 2002. Zinn led an extraordinary life. His work continues to influence many. He passed away in 2010 at the age of 87. His friend and fellow activist Noam Chomsky said of him, "Whenever there was a struggle for peace and justice, Howard was there, on the front lines, unflagging in his enthusiasm and inspiring in his integrity, engagement, eloquence, and insight." Howard Zinn's life and work are an unforgettable model, sure to leave a permanent stamp on how history is understood and how a decent and honorable life should be lived. And now, Howard Zinn.
This is supposed to be a question and answer session, right? I'm not giving a lecture. You're supposed to ask questions, and I'm supposed to pretend to answer them. So, you have questions? Yes.
Do you have any idea how we can move past this culture of denial? I mean, how is it possible that we can go forward and kind of fight the fight, you know, with everyone? I mean, there's almost resistance to the truth on every level that you go to.
Well, the way people always have. Truth has always been denied by people in power, and always been people who tried to resist that, oppose that, bring forth the truth. It's always taken time and persistence. I mean, you can go back to the anti-slavery movement, right? I mean, the slavery was not just supported in the South, it was supported in the North. the first abolitionists, the first people who spoke out against slavery in the North, were stoned and attacked and some of them killed. Yeah, there was a culture of denial then, you know, about slavery. But what happened? The movement grew. People persisted. People took risks. And this has been true of every movement. Every movement looks as if it's hopeless at the beginning. People seem as if they have no power. You look at recent history. This is the story of the civil rights movement, of the women's movement, you know, of the anti-war movement against the Vietnam War. And as I say, it goes back. You know, the abolitionists started with a small group of people. By the late 1850s, they were a national phenomenon. By the 1860s, by the time of the Civil War, Lincoln had to reckon with them, even though he was not an abolitionist. He was willing to put up with slavery so long as they could bring the Southern states back in the Union, but the movement was too strong. So, you know, what do we do? The most important thing we can do is not hold back.